As we started looking in chapter 12, there were a couple of things we pointed out as we were going through this. One has to do with the relationship that is largely in view in this section. What is it?
One another.
There were some attitudes we saw also that go throughout this section, really go out throughout the rest of the book. One of them in particular, what is that?
Love.
Love is the underlying attitude that's throughout this. There's another one that we see in terms of dealing with one another in particular. What was it?
Service.
Humility. Yeah, as far as attitude goes, there was a behavior that goes along this throughout this, and that is service. That statement was made. There's also a theme. I don't know if the theme is the right word. There's a contrast that shows up throughout this section, really shows up in several of the chapters. What is it? What do you keep saying, seeing compared here, contrasted?
Evil and good.
Okay, good and evil. And we'll see that, you see that in, I can't even remember now if I asked you to mark it, hopefully I did, somewhere back. If you mark evil and good throughout, from 12 on to I guess through 15, you'll see that that's showing up. Okay, we were looking at, I think we got down to verse 10. Be devoted to one another in brotherly love, give preference to one another in honor. I'm not sure, I mean, you know, and this is true with several of these. This could have reference to the give preference to one another in honor. Very well could be modifying the first half of that verse, or it may be just a standalone in its own right. What's the word honor mean?
Respect.
Respect. It's a good one word for it. Providing, showing value or having value, something having value, and you show it respect. And we'll see honor comes up a couple different times throughout this as well. And of course, give preference to one another is this question of whether or not humility is in play. Then he says, not lagging in diligence, and or lagging behind in diligence, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord. You know, one of the things, there's terminology, oxymoron, I guess. I'll put this one a different way. Is there such a thing as a lazy Christian? It's kind of a contradiction in terms, isn't it? And that's really, and as you look at the last part of, look in verse 11, you see that admonition not to be, if you look at it from the negative standpoint, not to be a lazy person, but rather to be diligent, to be committed, and to be fervent, have zeal. And then it goes on in terms of serving the Lord. And the reason I say that there's, you know, in some ways it connects, may very well be modifying what we started with in 10, is in throughout this we have mentioned about the serving aspect of it. And here's the nature of the service. If you're serving your brother, who are you actually serving? Or in addition, who are you serving, maybe you prefer? Yeah, serving God. And so if given what Paul's admonishing these brethren, exalting these brethren to do, don't do it half-heartedly. Don't do it in fits and starts. Be zealous about it and recognize that what you're doing is serving the Lord. Or in serving the Lord, serve the brethren. And then in verse 12, rejoicing in hope, persevering in tribulation, devoted to prayer. We've run into this terminology, similar terminology, earlier in chapter 5. In fact, let's go back for a second. It's a little different order than here. But in 5:3, he says, not only this, but we also exult in our tribulations, knowing that tribulation brings about perseverance. Perseverance, proving character, hope. And hope does not disappoint. And we've talked about that word exalt triumphant kind of rejoicing. I just say exult, didn't I? That's what I meant to say. It's triumphant kind of rejoicing. And here he says, he starts it kind of in the reverse order, rejoicing in hope, in recognition. I mean, even though he's going to follow on with tribulation, the fact that we have hope, we can rejoice in that, in spite of the tribulation. And yet he goes ahead and encourages perseverance in tribulation. And we've talked, I think, in the past about the power of prayer in terms of our being able to sustain ourselves under these kind of conditions. I'm going to draw our attention back. I'll make this statement that, and I think most of us know, you can go outside of Romans, you'll find all these things stated as they apply to how we ought to live our lives. What's interesting to me about this is, in this section, we've been dealing with this one another. And you think about tribulation, you mean you could be having tribulation from your brethren? Did the Jews and Gentiles have a form of tribulation underway, even as we've been talking about this?
Absolutely. Yes.
See, so and Paul's, as we've tried to reinforce, Paul's talking to saints and writing to saints, and so the things he has to say not only apply to us in terms of how we are lives outside the four walls of, or not outside the four walls, but outside of our brethren, the relationships with our brethren. Relationships with the world in terms of how we conduct ourselves, they certainly apply in terms of how we conduct ourselves with respect to our brethren. And you can have brethren that can be on the wrong side of God's will relative to you. If you live long enough, you'll run into it if you haven't already. I've kind of jumped over it, but maybe we'll come back in a minute and touch on it as far as examples you might have come up with. Finish out this one last one. He says, contributing to the needs of the saints, practicing hospitality. When he says contributing to the needs of the saints, what does he mean? What do you think?
Using whatever talents or resources you may have to help a saint.
Okay. So if I got $50 and somebody's in need, that's what it means, giving $50.
Not necessarily. I mean, he's been talking about some other things.
Anything that comes out. Okay, sorry.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Contextually, it's, like I said, it's not just, it's talents or resources or things that he mentions here.
It doesn't exclude financial, does it? But there's nothing in the context that demands it either. But rather, this is more of service, is it not? You can contribute or distribute, New King James, I think, says, to the needs of the saints. The saints have a variety of needs. In fact, he goes right on and makes the point, rejoice with those who rejoice, a little further on. And so, is that a need?
Contributing money might not be the need.
No. It may be very much a spiritual need. It may be an encouragement they need. It may be some other kind of service. Counseling they need. A shoulder to cry on they need. Somebody to hold up their hands they need. I mean, Paul, remember when Paul started out the book, he made this, if I can find it, verse 12 of chapter 1. Verse 11, he says, for I long to see you so that I may impart some spiritual gift to you that you may be established. That is, that I may be encouraged together with you while among you, each of us by the other's faithful for yours and mine. So there was even a need expressed, a desire expressed by Paul. It had nothing to do with finances, did it? Okay.
And the hospitality there, I mean, that could be one of the ways that you would do that. Contribute to the needs of. They may need hospitality.
Yeah, and what is hospitality? Dumb question, Otterback. What is hospitality?
Giving aid to. having people over. It depends on what dictionary you use.
Leading up your
use.
House real good for somebody.
Hospital comes from that. It's French.
It can be, it is a providing of, again, it can be somebody's in need of certainly from the standpoint of what he's been talking about, going back to verse 10, in terms of our relationship with our brethren, may very well be, I hate to use the word entertain, that's really not the right word, but to be with, to share your house, your meal with, to encourage, to interact with. He says given to, New King James, I think, says given to, right? Practicing is in New American Standard. Kind of interesting, the word practicing in the Greek. That same Greek word comes in the next verse, 14. Bless those who persecute. Mm-hmm. Persecute and practicing are the same word. So the charge is to persecute hospitality. Sounds funny, does. It's pursue.
Mine says pursuing, yeah.
Yeah, pursue.
Pursue.
The idea. What version are you using?
Zucchini.
You can keep sir? Good? Yeah. Okay. So pursue with, you know, having intent.
No, New American Standard. I'm not saying that. New American Standard.
Okay.
Is that your footnote, Jim, or is that what the text says?
It's in the text, yeah. It's literally pursuing.
New King James has the pursuing in the margin.
Footnote.
Just go and see what it really is, what the Greek is, yeah.
And here's in text.
Well, it says given, but in here it says pursuing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And of course, we think about persecute as in the negative, which is fair. That's what it's used most of the time. But here it's the case being in the positive, the more it's used. So pursue hospitality. As we were saying a moment ago, the contributing needs of the saints, that may be very well be what one aspect of it. Of course, down in verse 15, rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. There's a couple other needs that, I mean, they express themselves in a particular kind of need that is, I say need, those who rejoice, of course, are happy. Happy in some fashion, at some point, and as brethren, we ought to be happy for their good fortune, whatever it is, whatever they're happy about. And likewise, I think we maybe even talked about this in an earlier class: mourning with those who mourn, or weeping with those who weep. People need we need to have that kind of a closeness with the family of God, just like we have it with our own flesh family, and support one another in that way. Let's just backtrack a bit. Going back, I just found out, anybody in the class, y'all had any comments in terms of the things we've covered so far and examples that you think would be worth bringing up, or questions, comments?
Well, I just explained about verse 13. It just says it's an echo. I understand the context here doesn't really talk about physical needs, but couple chapters later, he does tell them he's going to Jerusalem, and there he specifies both physical and spiritual needs. And so, I still think it'd be a stretch to say this is an allusion to that same thing. But it's not that he doesn't address physical things as well.
And that could very well be the case here. In fact, if practicing hospitality is a dimension of this, that is a physical need, isn't it? So it isn't limited to either one. It incorporates both. Point.
Say you take somebody to the doctor. Is that under the heading of hospitality?
No.
Whatever it be.
No. No, I think it's... It is during the first one. It is the first half of this verse. That's right. That's it. Contribute to the needs of. I mean, you are providing a service to somebody.
Sure. I just have a thought.
But no, it's not hospitality. I understand the word.
Right.
Well, the last part of 14 where he says, bless and do not curse,
if he's referring to relationships that you have with brethren, is that an absolute statement or just a general one? Because the reason I'm asking is because this may be the answer to my question, but he did curse people at times, but they usually they were not of the faith, like in Galatians 5:12, where he prayed that the people that were troubling him would mutilate themselves, or Alexander the Coppersmith in 2 Timothy.
I think the point here, see if I can make it, I'm not sure I'll make the differentiation very well, but the point here, and first of all, what's the idea of bless, not curse? If you want to bless somebody, what are you trying to, what's that mean?
Wishing well, wishing good things to come.
You don't care, yeah, you're not wishing evil, just kind of the opposite. You're not wishing evil on, you're wishing for their good. The curse, of course, is to just really do the opposite. If you want evil to come upon them. He's going to go on and say, and go further on, to address those who are doing evil, who you might want to curse, leave that to God to take care of. Right?
Because God might take care of
it. You're getting there. We see a lot of David in his Psalms. He didn't hesitate to call upon God to curse people. And so, from the standpoint of the Christian's right, if you like, or the Christian design to have evil avenged. Yeah, in the Bible, I think it's pretty clear that there's nothing at odds with the Christian for doing that. I think here, this is a personal, this is you are persecuting me.
Okay.
That's what's in view.
Do you think this is more vendetta or revenge?
It is a revenge. In the context, it's revenge.
Okay.
You don't go after that person. You let God take care of that.
Okay.
And I don't know for sure if 13 is, when we get into 13, deal with government. One of the ways, depending on what the nature of the persecution is, like Paul was being persecuted toward the end of Acts by the Jews, what did he call upon? He called upon the government to step in. He was a citizen. And so, and I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit, but the government is also God's means of avenging. It's his agency for those kinds of things. But I think up here, primarily what he has in view is in the context of the nature of the one another, we can be done, evil can be done toward us by our brethren. We know it from our experience it can be, but also from what's been said here. And how do we react to that? And our reaction should not be vengeance. That's God's territory, which he goes on and says. All right. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay, let's wrap up this section. 16. Since we already hit 14 now. Be of the same mind toward one another. Do not be haughty in mind, but associate with the lowly. Do not be wise in your own estimation. Never pay back evil for evil to anyone. Respect what is right in the sight of men. To me, the 15, 16 is nothing but a general admonition about our attitude. How are we going to deal with those among us? And, you know, we can be haughty in mind, or we can recognize, and in view of what we've covered so far, what Paul's been preaching all along, and going back to 12:1, therefore, do we have any right to be anything but on? You think about it. I mean, we wouldn't, you know, it's by God's grace that they were what they were and we are what we are, by the mercy of God. So we don't have any basis on which to see ourselves better than somebody else. It's not unlike what he was dealing with in chapter 11, if you'll recall, between the Jews and the Gentiles in faith. You know, it's going to be very easy for the Gentiles to get a haughty attitude about the Jews who have been, because of their lack of faith, were no longer considered the people of God. And, you know, we're big guys now. We're the Gentiles. We are the people of God now. They could fall in the same trap the Jews had previous to them. So haughtiness has no place in the Christian. So never pay back evil for evil to anyone. This is easy to do, isn't it? I think this is one of those places that it helps, it should help you, it helps me, it should help me to think about who we follow, to think about the example of Christ. You just can't come up with a better example of somebody who had evil done toward them and yet never returned evil for evil. Paul, in terms of apostles, of course, to us, we've got so much data on him. We can be impressed by Paul and his ability to withstand the persecution he had. But he doesn't hold a candle, even at that, to Jesus and what he did. And so our eyes ought to be on Jesus as far as trying to deal with these kinds of challenges. Respecting what is right in the sight of men, we've talked about, I think we haven't, it's been covered here on a number of occasions, that I had a hard time, quite frankly, I ginned up one, thinking of something that would fall into this category that didn't end up being, in the first place, something I ought to do just because I'm trying to follow God. And I thought, the culture we lived in was something like it is in Saudi Arabia, where men run around and it's, you know, maybe thought normal to run around in these coats. You know, although I'd go over there, and that coat wouldn't mean anything to me, I might do that because that might hold some value to them. If I had an assignment over there, and they might look at me and say, you know, you're not living, you're not performing within our culture. It's not honorable for a man to be seen in pants. And so I might say, okay, I'll wear this, whatever they call that thing you wear. But I, a lot of things that have to do with what's honorable in the sight of man, are those things are probably, or in large cases, honorable in the sight of God. You may have come up with an example. You got one? Share it.
I was just thinking about, we were talking about the men's class at one time, about how you may be at a congregation where all the men wear suits and ties. You know, don't stick out like a sore thumb and just try to oppose it, because if you love them, you know. It may be something you need to do to, I don't know, that may not be a good example, but it's
all like my gown.
It may run the other way too, in verse 16, that word there, associate with the lowly, is what mine says. It actually, that is not just an attitude, that's accommodate yourself to lowly things. You may be in a situation where there's a whole lot of have-nots, and you might be the only have. And you're used to wearing a coat and tie, but nobody else owns one. And so what do you do to accommodate your brother to make them feel, like they're not less than? You know, do you flaunt your riches or what you have? Even by that, you give up even though you've always worn a coat and tie. What about not wearing that coat and tie so as to make them,
What is it speaking to, though? What's it speaking to? It's speaking to attitude. What is your attitude? Yeah. Your attitude may be, I'm a conscientious, for whatever reason, I'm a conscientious and not be able to show up in a side of full walls and worship with brethren without a coat and tie. That's different than feeling like, and then showing up with one because I want people to know that I happen to have enough money to wear a coat and tie. Two different things.
Right.
And so you got to be, attitude has an awful lot to do with it. The other one is respect what is honorable in the sight of all men. I took the case I gave you because I wanted to get outside of just among brethren and what is honorable before to the world. I guess it's all men and you. And so, you know, you may have other categories for that, or other items to throw in there. Anyway.
But the world doesn't look at things like you. They think a lot of things are honorable.
Some ways they do.
And some things they do, you know. But now, they even...
The world in general does not think it's appropriate to beat your children. Beat. Abuse. Well, I'm a Christian. I don't think it's right to abuse your children either. So that's why I say a lot of things as a Christian that I would not do, or that I would do, the world, this world that we live in, you know, those things generally are going to fit in the category of being honorable in the sight of men. But I'm just saying there's some things that must be that, you know, as a Christian, I wouldn't really give it second thought.
Maybe just culturally.
But it's a cultural issue.
But I mean, like, if you went to other cultures, it might be stuff that you wouldn't necessarily think right. to yourself, oh, that's being honorable. But if that's what they want you to do, if they want you to take
yeah,
your shoes
it's an
off
insult
before
to
you
them.
Enter, you know, or something
yeah.
like that.
Well,
yes.
So you think this section is not a one another context then, that we're in?
I don't think it in verse 17, I don't think it's limited to that. I just think all men carry it outside of that. But, you know, look, I'm not going to press that point.
It certainly would apply to brethren as well,
sure.
but it wouldn't be limited to that.
Sure.
It seems like it's more important.
That's just all men.
Anyone, yeah.
And the next statement is the same truth. Same thing is true in the next statement. Verse 18.
All men, yeah.
As far as it depends on you, be at peace with all men. Never take out your own revenge. I think it applies to brethren. I just think it's, you know, I see it as broad, can be broader than that. Okay. There is an argument. Sorry?
Isn't the rest of the chapter talking about our attitude toward the world instead of necessarily our attitude?
There is a transition. It's fair enough. There's a transition that happens because you look at it with respect to government. Government has to do with all men, not simply limited to brethren. So there is a transition where it happens exactly. I don't think it. I think it happens after 16. Say that.
There's a transition, but his audience obviously is still Christian.
For sure.
When you come back to 14, it looks towards more of a one another kind of thing, too. Yeah. So it's just kind of out of scope. It's still...
There's the things he's going to say in 13 and 4 chapter. You're talking about 14 chapter? Chapter,
yeah,
14.
Chapter 14.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay, look, let's get on with it, because I'm going to cover 13. We're going to cover lesson 19. Let's talk about revenge just a minute. What is vengeance?
Gaze.
Gaze. Repaying. Dealing out punishment, kind of dealing out punishment for evil. Something done against you, and you react to it. So it really is vindicating your own right in a way. And it's in revenge is the idea of sort of, I'm going to inflict punishment some kind for the bad you did to me. And so the you know, in this, it says never pay back evil. Never take out your own revenge, beloved, but leave room for the wrath of God, for it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay. So leave that to God. Evil will be done. We live in an evil world. And it's not to say that we are milquetoast and can't protect our rights within the government, but what it says is ours is not to avenge the wrong done. God will take care of that at some point in time. And, you know, you're going to have trials and tribulations that come into your life that you're going to feel, I suppose, that you know, you're going to know you were not done right. And you want to have that avenged. The question is, how is it done? And you can ruin yourself real quickly. In fact, 21 says, do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Two ways you can think about being overcome by evil. That is, an evil person overcoming you, an evil event overcoming you, and you overcome that with good. I think more likely what it means is, don't you be overcome by evil. You're evil. Don't let evil overcome you, but rather you overcome evil with good. And so it's really applying to how are you gonna act? How are you gonna perform?
Okay. Maybe goes back to verse 2, where you have a choice to make. You're either going to be conformed or transformed.
Right. Good point. Good observation. Okay, 13. 13 means lesson 19. It says every person is to be in subjection to the governing authorities. So there is no authority except from God, and those who exist are established with God. Who are the governing authorities? Let me do this quick. What are the governing authorities?
God is the sovereign, and then government. Yeah.
You get government when you read down 6, 7, further down. Really, all throughout this. Somebody said sovereign. God, sovereign, that kind of thing. We know, this is a rehash, we know God is the only one who has inherent authority. He's sovereign authority. All of the authority is what kind?
God-given,
delegated. God has authority because He is our Creator. It gives Him a right. I ask you the question, what's the objective of God establishing authority among men?
So be order.
For the good of man.
For our good. Yeah, for our good.
And to punish the evildoer.
Yeah, for our good.
Right,
but that's still,
yeah.
For our, fundamentally, it's for
if
our good.
On the right side of the road when they're right.
That was crazy people, ain't it? So why are we to be subject to governing authority?
Because God put it in place.
Rule number one, God said so. Okay. It within the text, there are several things stated within the text. Did you catch what they were? Some reasons why we should be subject.
Well, generally speaking, they shouldn't be a problem to us.
Generally speaking, they shouldn't be a problem to us. If they're really a fear
to those who are evil,
right.
And it's assumed here that the readers are not evil. Why would we have a problem with God?
It says, for it is a minister of God, verse 4, to you for good. But if you do what is evil, be afraid. So, one reason to be under it is it is for our good. Another reason to be under it is...
Because God said so.
We got that one already.
For the wrath.
For the wrath. The negative side of it. For the wrath, right?
Something bad's going to happen to you.
God's wrath, ultimately, the government's wrath, short term, temporal. Both come into play. If we decide, let me ask you a question: is obeying the laws of land, is disobeying the government a sin?
Yes.
Not always. Most of the time.
Not always. Depends on whether or not I'm the one doing the speeding, I'm telling you. I know the answer to that. Are all rulers good?
No.
When this was written?
No.
No way. Do we need to obey the laws of the land?
Yes.
Good ruler or bad ruler?
I have a hard time with that.
Well?
If I was under occupation of German troops and they were murdering my family and doing all these things, I'm supposed to be docile and...
No, wait a minute. What? You're under the authority. What's the exception to that? There's an exception.
God's law.
And it violates God's law. Now, here's the point you have the trouble. You're going to have trouble with. You could have trouble with. Here's an extension. Big extension. Our government, pick one that everybody can relate to. Our government, our abortion is a law of the land. Right to abort is a law of the land. So should we rise up against the government because of that?
They rise up against abortion.
Yeah, we can speak out to the evil.
Right.
Speak out to the evil. It doesn't give a right to rise up to the government.
All you have to do,
if you want to see by example that being the case, all you have to do is look at the first century, the time, the whole book of Acts will tell you that. I mean, everything that was going on under Roman rule, not everything, the Roman rule had a tremendous amount of evil associated with it. But nowhere do you find Jesus, and Jesus was under the Roman rule. Did he rise up against the Roman rule?
No, he spoke out against it.
But he spoke for
what was right.
Truth, what was right. And if and yet he didn't say rise up against the government, quite to the contrary. Just like Paul is going to say here.
Pay your taxes. Support the government.
Support the government. They're there for your good. And so, you know, our rising up against the government, can you speak out? In this country, you can certainly speak out against the government, speak out against the
law.
In terms of the politics of it, you can speak out against it. We have the benefit of free speech. But you know, there might be a case where you don't have that right someday. So what are you going to do about it?
There's nothing in this passage or Peter that talks about living in a democratic government.
Absolutely not.
No.
But too many Christians got this idea that this is really for the good old U.S. of A and our current government. That couldn't be any farther from it.
It's like slaves with bad masters. They had no recourse, and they weren't to be ugly.
All right. Somebody jumped ahead and said, "For because of this, you also pay taxes for rulers or servants of God, devoting themselves to this very thing. Render to all what is due them, tax to whom tax is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor." Talked about honor earlier. Respect for the authority, because God put it in place. That's the reason. Now, he, you know, don't ask me if he put Barack Obama in place.
Or Hitler.
Or Hitler. In the sense of, I'm going to make this come about. I have no idea about the providential workings of God. I'm not that smart. I won't even waste my time trying to figure it out, because I can't. But I know God is in control, and I know God sees the end play, and I know you and I have one thing to be concerned about, and that is, how do we live in view of our God? If our relationship is right between us and God, the rest of this stuff really doesn't matter. It's here 50, 60, 70, 80 years if you're around that long.
That's what he's saying in verse 5. It's but also for conscience sake. I think that's the idea, is that no matter what God has made a decision on, or we don't know what he's made a decision on. If we're doing what God expects us to do, then we know we're okay.
Yeah. And in this context, it's obeying the government, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Laws of the one government. Even though we might not agree with it. Okay. Verse 8. Owe nothing to anyone except to love one another. Here's our love again, and our one another again. But he who loves his neighbor has fulfilled the law. You shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet. And if there's any other commandment, it is summed up in this saying, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no wrong to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of the law. Paul, as we talked about before, Paul, or to start out tonight, this thing of love has shown up throughout this. I ask you the question, is love ever paid up?
No.
Maybe where Christ is concerned?
With where you're concerned. Can you ever pay up love? Can you ever love too much?
No.
You know, done your dues. Now you can take, you're retired from work. Well, you're not retired from work, actually. But you're retired from the company you work for. So you gave up on that. You don't do that anymore. Love, if you put so much love behind you, and if you take care of your love commitment...
I sure do. We have a get-together around every Christmas. Make sure I go.
You take care of your love commitment that's talked about here.
It's out of love.
How to care for those people. You're saying something, Ron?
1 Corinthians 13 doesn't say love takes no account. So, doesn't that
keeps a record.
Why? Yeah, there's no record. There's no quantifying. There's never. And that, I know it's a little bit of a twist on it, but it's still the idea that it's not something you do to catch up or to pay back. It's just you just do it. You just keep doing it.
And that's, you know, here, it says owe nothing, an idea owe nothing except for love. I mean, that isn't restricting. I mean, people can get caught up in that. That's not restricting owing anything. So, if so, Paul would talk to himself. Go back to the letter of Philemon. You can see that. It isn't that kind of owing. It's really, the one thing we can't pay up. The one thing we can't pay out is love. And continue to have love for brethren. In this context, love for neighbor, actually. It's even broader than brethren.
Well, in 1 Corinthians 13, it also says love never fails. To me, never. It never ends. It never should fail.
It's talking about what's going to be lasting versus what's going to be temporal. It's going to be temporary.
But it's still, at the same time, and there, I mean, it's true. It just keeps on. It does not end.
That's right.
It does not end. Okay, verse 11. Do this knowing that the time that is almost, there's already the hour for you to be awakened from sleep. For now salvation is nearer to us than when we believe. The night is almost gone and the day is near. Therefore, let us lay aside the deeds of darkness and put on the armor of light. Let us behave properly as in the day, not in carousing or drunkenness, not in sexual promiscuity, sensuality, not in strife and jealousy, but put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh in regard to its lust. He describes a situation here, at least the way I wrote it down, that is, in figurative terms, he's making a contrast. And really drawing their attention to something, using this awake and asleep. And when you look at what he goes on to say, I guess what I want to say is, for the Christian, for these Christians as well at this time, Paul's point to them is now is the time. They do not need to be putting off. As he says, it's already the hour for you to awaken. In other words, they need to be practicing the things that Paul has been covering throughout all of this. They need to be putting that to work. The idea of salvation nearer us than when we believe, I think, is nothing more than the idea that salvation, our ultimate salvation, our eternal salvation, is just one day closer today than it was yesterday. We have a finite period of time to live. Now, how are we going to live it? Are we going to live it in the light? Are we going to stay in the darkness? That's the contrast he's making. And he's saying, therefore, lay aside the deeds of darkness and let's put on the armor of light. And he describes then what you do when you behave properly in the day. You don't do these things that are associated with the things of the night, which really, things of darkness, things of sin. And so he describes, well, you know, things like carousing, easier word, carousing, which is revelry, sexual promiscuity, strife, jealousy, you know, just not an all-inclusive list, but a list that describes the kind of thing that we need to be not practicing. These things are not good, they are evil. Even just like he's been talking about throughout. And so he says, put on Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh in regard to its lust. So that really pretty well encapsulates everything that might be lust related to the flesh. Okay?
Do you think he's still, you know, he's adding to the thought of deeds of darkness versus light. Is that what he's doing?
In verse
13
and 14. Oh, yeah, that's what all of this. Sure. Okay, we will pick up in lesson 20 Sunday, Lord willing. 20 and 21 are up here. I mean, 21, 21's, you ought to have 20 if you got 19. 21 I put out tonight.